Comprehensive, vehement, and maniacally obsessive video review of Phantom Menace. The review lasted 70 minutes, so Stoklasa chopped it up into 7 10-minute YouTube videos. As unpromising as that sounds, a review that's more than half the length of the movie, the videos were promoted on Twitter by prominent geeks such as Simon Pegg and Lost showrunner Damon Lindelof, and subsequently seen by more than 5 million people. Stoklasa followed up with 90-minute reviews of Clones, Sith, and dozens of other movies, also chopped up into digestible chunks. Stoklasa's YouTube channel, Red Letter Media, has now racked up more than 46 million views, most of them from the prequel reviews. What's the appeal? Stoklasa plays the Jester, adopting a character created by a friend named Harry Plinkett, the never-seen narrator of the reviews. Plinkett, it emerges, is part film nerd, part serial killer, off his meds, and frequently off topic. He offers several times to mail pizza rolls to his viewers. Stoklasa draws on his Chicago film school education to skewer Lucas's approach. How episode 1 and 2 lack a real protagonist. How much of episode 3 employs the dull editing technique known as no-shoot reverse shot. But by putting it in the Plinkett persona, he is simultaneously parodying the obsessive Star Wars fan. Perhaps the most ironic result of Plinkett's popularity, one fan decided to blog a rebuttal of everything in Stoklasa's prequel reviews, point by point. This screed, unintentionally Plinkett-like, ran to 108 pages. Stoklasa intended to show that the Emperor wore no clothes. I'm not convinced that George is this genius filmmaker that he's always been portrayed as being, he says. I see him as a guy who had a neat idea to make a space adventure movie in the spirit of the old Flash Gordon serials, modernize it a little, make it share a lot of visual elements with World War II, add some mythological elements and call it Star Wars, then get a whole other bunch of people to make it work somehow. He works best when other people take his ideas and work with them. When he writes and directs, it's disastrous. Stoklasa makes this point elegantly in the most oft-cited section of his Episode 1 review, which has him asking four fans who've seen both the original trilogy and Phantom Menace to describe characters from each without describing their appearance or profession. Han Solo is roguish, dashing, arrogant, a scoundrel, walks the line, has a good heart. Qui-Gon Jinn is... Well, Stoklasa's four panelists have a very hard time coming up with a description until one suggests stern? 3PO is prissy, bumbling, cowardly, anal retentive. Padme Amidala is... The fans cannot come up with a single description that doesn't mention her makeup, clothes, or royal position, and it seems to be a genuine revelation. This is funny, says one. I get it. The most damning words in the Plinkett reviews, however, come from Lucas and McCallum themselves. Stoklasa has done his homework, clipping quotes from DVD extras and documentaries that show the director and producer at their most inane. It's like poetry. It rhymes, Lucas is shown telling his staff of the script repeatedly. It's so dense. Every single image has so much going on, says McCallum. Stoklasa plays this quote in the context of some of the prequel's profoundly confusing special effects shots, where it isn't entirely clear whom we're supposed to be following or why. Suddenly, it seems McCallum is describing a movie full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. The clips give us the best sense of the exhaustion, creatively and physically, that seemed to dominate the production of the prequels. He shows clips of Lucas slumped in his director's chair with a large Starbucks cup or surrounded by people whose facial expressions speak volumes. Lucas jokes about not having finished the scripts yet. His underlings smile while their eyes display the terror of someone trapped on an eternal funhouse ride. To paraphrase something Lucas once said about his father, he is the boss, the one they fear. It was around this time, in the 2004 documentary Empire of Dreams, that Lucas started comparing his life story to that of Darth Vader's, a man trapped in the Lucasfilm machine. We see the actors against green screen with two cameras, and every non-action scene looks boringly similar. Two actors walk slowly down a corridor or through a room, stop, turn to a window. As if this isn't boring enough, Stoklasa points out, nearly all of the important discussions in Sif take place on couches. Once you realize this sort of thing about the prequels, it is a hard thing to unsee. For all his anger, Stoklasa denies himself some of the easy jabs favored by prequel haters. He doesn't blame Hayden Christensen's performance as Anakin. Even Sir Laurence Olivier couldn't make this shit work, mumbles Plinkett. As for Jar Jar Binks, you can make an argument that Jar Jar was the only thing you could understand clearly, Stoklasa says. He had some kind of motivation and a character arc. He was annoying, yes, but ironically, he was the most realistic and understandable thing in Phantom Menace. Stoklasa is a bait noir for prequel defenders, largely because every Star Wars story and forum now seems to contain comments from people who link to his videos rather than voice their own opinion. But underneath its twisted humor, his is a relatively reasoned and educated take. Other commentators have taken a far cruder approach. In 2005, a band called The Waffles wrote a song called George Lucas Raped Our Childhood. 3 years later, the creators of South Park went even closer to the bone in an episode in which Lucas is shown raping a stormtrooper. Hell hath no viciousness like a Star Wars fan spurned. When denial and anger have run their course, there's always bargaining. Since Star Wars fans are such a creative bunch, everyone disappointed by the prequels has shared this thought. I could have done better. Arguments over exactly how each prequel movie could have been made better have been raging in bedrooms, dorm rooms, and coffee shops for years. Monday morning quarterbacking is fun, up to a point. But this is Monday through Sunday morning quarterbacking, and it doesn't look as if it's ever going to end. The poster boy for bargaining over the prequels is Michael Barraty, a 26-year-old YouTube star from Los Angeles. Like Stoklasa, Barraty is a film school graduate from UCLA, Coppola's alma mater. But he's younger and way more upbeat in his outlook. Barraty was a child actor on Nickelodeon when he was in high school and played the young Jerry Seinfeld in an HBO special. He still has the excitable voice and wide-eyed shotgun delivery of a children's TV presenter. When episode 1 came out, Barraty was 12. No bitter old fogey he. But there were things that soon grew to bother him and his friends about the movie, such as the fact that it really seemed as if it should have been Obi-Wan's story, and that Darth Maul's death wasted a perfectly good villain. In 2012, Lucasfilm re-released The Phantom Menace, this time in 3D. Barraty, who ran what was then a minor movie-focused YouTube channel called Belated Media, wanted to do a video review that focused only on the elements he liked. Plinkett is skewering and deconstruction, and it's remarkable, Barraty says. But I didn't just want to pan the film. Nobody goes to a movie to be disappointed. I've been trying to skew more positive. It turned out there simply weren't enough elements he liked to base a review on, though, so instead, Barraty let his imagination roam through a slightly altered version of the movie. The resulting video is called What If Episode 1 Were Good? It took a year for it to go viral, but viral it went. It has now been seen more than 2 million times. Barraty's channel went from 5,000 to 100,000 subscribers. His new fans began clamoring for a follow-up, What If Episode 2 Were Good?, which Barraty, more of a movie fan than specifically a Star Wars fan, had never intended to make. In 2013, he relented. The result got another 1 million views in the space of a week, and Barraty began to be bombarded with emails from fans with their own alternate script ideas. I unknowingly swatted the biggest hornet's nest in fandom, he says. He's still working on his Episode 3 video. Barraty's is an infectious alternate vision of Episode 1, and unlike much of the Monday morning quarterbacking, it is an elegant proposition with as few changes to the movie as possible. In Barity's telling, Jar Jar Binks is removed altogether, though the Gungans remain. Obi-Wan is moved to the foreground, becoming the protagonist, but his master, Qui-Gon, is still present. Anakin is brought up in age, and Qui-Gon can simply sense the Force is strong with him, rather than testing him for midichlorians. Padme flirts with Obi-Wan, who later saves her life, diverting him from the lightsaber battle with Darth Maul. Maul kills Qui-Gon and survives, setting up Obi-Wan to hunt Maul down in later movies. Yoda is largely absent from the Jedi Council, creating a sense of mystery around the character. Palpatine becomes a functionary who mediates between the Jedi Council and the Senate, a role that gives him more strings to pull. And that is pretty much it. Barity speedily recounts the scenes that follow logically from these decisions, with plenty of jump cuts and visual gags to keep us entertained as we walk through the land of might have been. But of course, the Star Wars that might have been wasn't. This is the ultimate problem with the bargaining stage of grief. At some point, the fantasy has to collapse, and we experience the pain of the prequels all over again. Everyone has their preferences. Everyone carries their own version of Star Wars in their heads. Expanded Universe author Timothy Zahn hated the midichlorian concept of the Force. "I hope that it will be dropped," he said in 2000, in vain, as it turned out. Midichlorians were mentioned again in Revenge of the Sith. Even Kyle Newman, prequel defender, would have had one actor and one actor only play Anakin throughout the prequels. The fictional Mr. Plinkett, at least, accepts the reality of what happened in the prequels. "Perhaps the worst thing about them is that they will be around forever," he says in deathly monotone at the very beginning of his Phantom Menace review. "They will never go away. They can never be undone." All thinking Star Wars fans must at some point wrestle with the significant gap between the shining, perfect idea of Star Wars and its sometimes less than perfect execution. The most passionate fans are often the most perfectionist, so they wrestle with this problem a lot, and this can lead them to the penultimate stage of Star Wars grief, depression. Nobody can say how widespread a condition prequel depression is. But remember those Darth Vader YouTube parodies I mentioned back in Chapter 9? The most viewed of all is The Star Wars That I Used to Know, 15 million views. A parody of Godier's monster 2012 hit, which feature Vader singing to George Lucas, "No, you didn't have to make them blow. What happened to the Star Wars that I used to know?" No fan wants this state of mind. It just descends on them. Not so much like the dark side of the Force, but more like the version of the dark side that Lucas conceived during the second draft of Star Wars, the Bogan Force. When you're struck with the Bogan as that early version Han Solo was, you too have to drive it from your mind. Otherwise you find yourself in the garbage masher with a line of thought that might go something like this. "It's no use trying to love Star Wars the way you once did. You can't go home again. You can't find the spirit of 1977 except in history books. We're know-it-alls now, as the Navajo Nation's Manny Wheeler put it. The internet is filled with us. We're too ready to throw our peanuts from the gallery and loudly opine on the nearest social media soapbox about what we would do differently. No one can just enjoy a sunset, so no one can successfully tell an epic, non-ironic story anymore. We lose the ability to be enraptured as teenagers. We gave in to hate. We got the prequels we deserved. We should accept that this was just diverting doggerel for children. Its creator couldn't come up with new ideas, so enough movies that rhymed with the predecessors. This is the fate of all creators and all creative endeavors. They get tired. They get repetitive. The whole Joseph Campbell monomyth thing was just a pretentious layer self-consciously applied by Lucas in the 1980s and agreed upon by a society that was so desperate for escapism, so enamored with newfangled special effects, that it placed three movies on a pedestal that nothing else could reach, when really, they were on rickety foundations to begin with. The only solution is to give up on Star Wars altogether and commit ourselves. Let us sell the Star Wars figures in the attic. Let us put away childish things." If that's the way you're thinking by this point in the chapter, if you've hit rock bottom in prequel grief, then perhaps it's time for a come-to-Jesus moment, or a come-to-the-force moment if you prefer. Let me introduce you to a good old-fashioned revival preacher. Acceptance is the hardest stage of the grieving process, but also the most crucial. Only by understanding the prequel movies the way they are, not the way they might have been, can fans hope to move on and find peace in their perception of the franchise. I wanted to see the prequels the way defenders saw them, so I turned to Brian Young, Star Wars blogger at StarWars.com, among other places, podcaster, and one of the smartest and most reliable defenders of the prequels on the planet. When Phantom Menace came out, Young had just graduated high school and waited in line for 30 days at his theater in Utah. Unlike the rest of the guys in line, he actually worked at the theater and was able to see the movie 70 more times. His son was born immediately after Clones. Young named him Anakin. A solid-looking guy with an utterly unflappable demeanor, Young moderated a few Why We Love the Prequels panels at conventions. And he has done what no one else, to my knowledge, has dared. One drunken night at a celebration in 2012, he defended the prequels in person to Jake Lloyd, the actor who played Anakin Skywalker in Episode 1. Lloyd quit acting after that movie. Now, in his early 20s, he bears an unambiguous, sneering disdain for the film, for which he was hounded throughout high school and college. Young didn't exactly succeed in winning Lloyd over to the prequels. Lloyd simply disengaged when he found out the name of Young's son, and later unfriended him on Facebook. I sat down with Young for several hours and craft beers in his hometown, Salt Lake City, and I told him I was going to play devil's advocate. I was going to hit him with every problem anyone ever had with the first three movies, every question I could come up with. He nodded stoically. "Dealing with prequel hate is my specialty," he said. "Ladies and gentlemen, Brian Young, Star Wars therapist." To begin, then, the dialogue. It was uniformly dreadful throughout episodes 1 to 3, right? To my surprise, Young didn't disagree. "George Lucas is not a writer," he said simply, and of course the creator himself has said as much. "Then how," I asked, "are we to take the dialogue, as an intentional, humorous pastiche of Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers?" Young nodded sagely. "I have to take it that way if I'm going to enjoy the movies." For the kind of fan who needs in-universe reasons for things, Young has one of those explanations for their stilted dialogue, too. These three films deal mostly with aristocrats and politicians, queens and senators, the highfalutin Jedi Council. To hear how that kind of person talks in the original trilogy, listen to Princess Leia and Grand Moff Tarkin. They do talk in that really stilted faux-Victorian style the prequels are permeated with, Young said. Only there isn't a Han Solo character to come in and roll his eyes at everything and sound cool. That kind of character doesn't exist in the prequels because we're in a different world. You're dealing with royalty. In the classic trilogy, you're dealing with every farm boy and shit-kicker in the galaxy. Ah, but there was one prominent member of the unsophisticated class, Jar Jar Binks. Surely there was no defense for this prattling, insufferable addition to the Star Wars canon. Again, Young was disarming. He found Jar Jar totally obnoxious, just like the rest of us. "It took me a while to come around to why he was in the story," he said. It wasn't until he was watching an episode of Clone Wars with his daughter, who was 8 at the time, in which Jar Jar featured. She declared that Star Wars wasn't Star Wars without Jar Jar. "He's supposed to speak to the kids and be obnoxious to everybody else," Young explained. "He's obnoxious to all the other characters. The moral of the story is you have to put up with these annoying people sometimes. You still have to treat them with dignity and respect. Every life has value." It's hard to argue with that defense of Jar Jar, and it certainly beats the argument I've heard from Lucas on stage at Celebration, that contemporary viewers hated 3PO in the original movies just as much as they did Jar Jar in the prequels. That's a false equivalence, if ever I heard one. Regarding Young contemplatively over our beers, I began to think Lucasfilm should hire him to go on the road and evangelize. An old-time prequel preacher. As Devil's Advocate, it was time to take the gloves off. How about the casting of Hayden Christensen as Anakin in Attack of the Clones, I asked him. Surely, Young didn't buy Anakin's painfully whiny attempts to romance Padme in that movie. Turns out he did. He isn't any more or less whiny than Mark Hamill in Episode 4, he said, and it wasn't hard to tell what line Young was thinking about. But I was going to Tosche Station to pick up some power converters! Even today, Hamill defends his delivery of this line as deliberately whiny. It was so that Luke Skywalker would have an arc that took him from willful teenager to mindful Jedi Knight. Christensen acted appropriately for the situation he was in, Young believes. Think about it. You're a celibate monk who doesn't know how to deal with a girl, and all of a sudden you're thrust into a situation with probably the most attractive woman in the galaxy? You're going to act like an idiot and talk even stupider. Can you remember the first thing you said to a girl as a teenager? Was it any better than, I don't like sand. It's rough, coarse, irritating, and it gets everywhere. I conceded that it was not. When Young does take issue with the prequels, it tends to be over the kind of thing you only notice after you've watched each movie dozens of times, such as the few scenes in Attack of the Clones, where Ewan McGregor, filmed in pickup months after the original shoot, wears a fake beard that's glued on like a toupee. Young doesn't see what I see in much of McGregor's performance, boredom and barely disguised contempt. Maybe, just maybe, that perception vanishes when you've watched these movies as many times as Young has. Nostalgia and familiarity are two things people don't attach to the prequels, he said. If they did, they'd like them more. Think about it. By the time Episode 1 came out, how many times had you seen Episode 4? I admitted that I'd worn out my dad's VHS tape of Star Wars back in 1983 and stopped counting after I'd seen it 50 times. There you go, Young said. Part of the feeling of watching a Star Wars movie is knowing it inside and out. I saw Episode 1 7 times over that first weekend, and I guarantee I liked it more the 7th time than the first. The more he watched the prequels, the more parallels between the trilogies Young found. He saw and heard that rhyming Lucas kept talking about, and he liked it. Anakin's and Luke's journeys started to mirror each other. Both ignore their training in their second movie because of their emotional attachments, for example. When Young heard about Machete Order, he embraced it, but reinserted Episode 1 and now enthuses about how much it enhances the rhyming. You see Anakin's fall in its entirety after Empire Strikes Back. Then, the first time you see Luke in Return of the Jedi, he's dressed all in black and choking pig guards in Jabba's palace. You can't help but wonder, has he fallen like his father? The prequels enhance the experience of the classic film so much it's disgusting, Young says. We went on for hours like this. Young handled everything I threw at him. The fact that the dirty, used universe style seems to vanish in the prequels to the point where historically inept reviewers chided Lucas for shunning the grime of Alien or Blade Runner, that just makes it clear how much of a mess the Empire has made of the galaxy by the time we get to Episode 4. Midichlorians in the bloodstream? They just showed that the Jedi were spending way too much time studying, over-intellectualizing everything. Young came out with the responses so readily, so naturally, that it was clear he wasn't just rationalizing. He genuinely believes in the prequels, as do millions more, whether they feel comfortable admitting it in public or not. I may never be able to watch Episodes 1 through 3 without wincing, or perhaps playing them on mute with John Williams in the background, but I have finally made my peace with them. The novelizations of each movie are helping in this process. In those, at least, there are no worries about wooden dialogue or poor acting. Legendary fantasy author Terry Brooks clearly enjoyed himself turning Phantom Menace into prose. He called it a dream project. Brooks's literary version of Jar Jar is a sympathetic exiled Gungan who just wants to make things right with his people. Matthew Woodring Stover's interpretation of Revenge of the Sith is a minor classic, much beloved by fans. It fleshes out much of Anakin's motivation that was missing from the movie. Other entries in the expanded universe also have the benefit of resolving flaws and absences in the prequels. That whole Sifo-Dyas plot hole is tied up in the 2005 novel Labyrinth of Evil. The tragedy of Darth Plagueis, the story Palpatine tells Anakin at the opera in Episode 3, but which he leaves tantalizingly sketchy, was fleshed out into novel form in 2012's Darth Plagueis. In short, if you want to find a new angle on the prequels, they are there for the taking. You could, for example, consider the possibility that there were actually two ideas of Star Wars. One idea belonged to us, the audience, and it was of a believable universe of cheerable heroes and hissable villains, one that transfigured the retelling into something darker, weightier, more mythological, more adult. We saw Sergio Leone in a desert landscape, when it was really only that desolate because the creator didn't have the budget to properly populate it. And this was fine. Then there was the other idea of Star Wars. The creator's idea. It was always a little bit goofier and a lot more stuffed with wacky aliens and Land of Zoom spaceships. It was Flash Gordon fan fiction intended for children and our inner children. And this, too, was fine. And if you just can't appreciate the prequel movies or rationalize them away, does that make you any less of a Star Wars fan? Certainly not, just so long as you're the live-and-let-live type. Star Wars is a buffet, Young says. Take what you want and leave the rest for everyone else. You don't put your finger in the mashed potatoes if you don't like them. If it helps, consider the prequels are as effectively one long Shaggy Dog story. Anakin Skywalker is supposed to bring balance to the Force, the meaning of which seems blithely accepted by the Jedi Council, but little explained. Yoda and company simply seem to believe that the prophecy means something good. But after the prequels, so far as we know, there are two Jedi left in the galaxy, Obi-Wan and Yoda, and two Sith, Palpatine and Vader. That's balance, right? Lucas went even further, suggesting that bringing balance to the Force would only be achieved at the end of Return of the Jedi. The prophecy was right, he said in 2005. Anakin was the chosen one, and he does bring balance to the Force. He takes the ounce of good left in him and destroys the Emperor out of compassion for his son. The prequels thus become a fable with a moral, and the moral is, don't believe everything that's foretold. For example, don't believe a filmmaker who says there will never, ever be any more Star Wars movies, period. 26. Using the Universe. The Star Wars saga seemed like it was just getting settled into its happy retirement on June 25, 2005, just over a month after the release of Revenge of the Sith. It was another mild and foggy summer day in San Francisco. The Coronet had not been able to show that last episode of the franchise it helped birth. Suffering from declining ticket sales, the theater had closed its doors for the last time in March and would be razed 2 years later to make way for a senior citizen center. In the Presidio, walking distance from the Coronet, George Lucas welcomed the press to the official opening ceremony for Lucasfilm's new $350 million headquarters. Called the Letterman Digital Arts Center, it would bring together most of the company's disparate divisions. ILM would move down from San Rafael. Lucasfilm's licensing and marketing arms would relocate from the ranch, and the video game branch, LucasArts, would arrive from the Overflow Ranch, Lucas's property next door to Skywalker, known as Big Rock. The opening was celebrated with one of Lucasfilm's now-famous all-day picnics. The picnics were Lucas at his most generous. Attendees, myself included, all collected meticulously crafted wooden picnic boxes inscribed with the date and location. We got serenaded by Bonnie Raitt and Chris Isaac and served by a ridiculously good-looking waitstaff. A VIP audience ranging from real politicians, Nancy Pelosi, Barbara Boxer, to fake politicians, Richard Schiff, who played Toby on The West Wing, wandered the winding stone paths of the 17-acre headquarters, taking in its view of the Palace of Fine Arts and the Golden Gate Bridge, downtown San Francisco, and the delights of the Marina District's Chestnut Street were a short drive and walk, respectively, to the east. Such a dramatic relocation had been necessary, and not just because Skywalker, Big Rock, and the ILM facility in San Rafael were bursting at the seams. Coming to the city just felt healthier. "We spent a lot of years hidden away," said Micheline Chow, the former healthcare industry executive and accountant who became Lucasfilm president in 2003. "I'm not sure if it was good for the company as a whole." Lucasfilm had long been proselytizing for digital movies, and what better place to do that than in the world capital of digital ideas? What Chow didn't say, however, was that without more Star Wars to make, the company would need to drum up business in order to maintain the same level of employees. Lucasfilm couldn't rely on the goodwill of a benign billionaire forever. Lucas had used his earnings from the first Star Wars movie to build Skywalker Ranch on a 1,700-acre plot of land in a Marin County valley. A World War II hospital had been demolished to make way for the second great house that Star Wars built. Bodies had been found on the grounds, and stories of hauntings by the staff would lead Chow to pay for a company-wide exorcism late one night that involved sprinkling rice around supposedly haunted sections of the building. The site soon acquired a restaurant and cocktail bar called Dixie's, whose bartender, when I visited at least, had a lightsaber tattooed on his middle finger. There was a super-fast fiber-optic connection to Skywalker Ranch running through the state-of-the-art servers in the Letterman Center's basement, annihilating time and distance between the two ends of the Lucas Empire. The ranch would always be called just that, whereas Lucas and ILM employees, 1,500 of whom were about to start moving to Letterman at the time of the opening picnic, would take to calling the new facility the Death Star. When, in time, Disney took over Lucasfilm, and hundreds of these same employees were fired in rolling waves of layoffs, some of them would start to employ a darker nickname for the site. Mousewitz. Rising to address the crowd in one of Letterman's large, light atriums on the day of the opening ceremony, Lucas mumbled through some remarks. He noted how fitting it was that Letterman had been completed at the same time as Revenge of the Sith, because both had begun at the same time, 3 years earlier. Sith had been released 5 weeks earlier and was, of course, another unqualified success. In a year in which movie attendance was declining precipitously and there were no real blockbusters, Episode 3 ruled the roost. In 6 weeks in the United States alone, it made $361,471,114, or more than three times Lucas's budget. Fans had still camped out for tickets, even though online ordering was widely available. The line had become a ritual in itself. In Seattle, one obsessive fan began camping out for Episode 3 tickets a record 139 days in advance. In media interviews after his remarks, Lucas announced that he had sworn off making $100 million movies for good, with the air of a man who was taking his winnings and getting out of town. Oh, he'd always be connected to the realm of special effects thanks to ILM, which at the time was working on new movies from franchises like Harry Potter and Pirates of the Caribbean, as well as a certain flick about a lion, a witch, and a wardrobe. Indiana Jones 4, which Lucas was then writing for Spielberg, didn't count. He meant he'd sworn off $100 million Star Wars movies, not $100 million movies in general. "A lot of Star Wars is over," he said, "in terms of the features." What was Lucas going to do next? Why, he said, he was going to go off and write my own little experimental films. He concluded his press interviews, and off he walked into the corridors of the Death Star, adorned with a half-dozen Darth Vader statues and a Jar Jar Binks in carbonite that had been presented to him by the 501st Legion. Experimental films? Right. In fact, as Lucas had announced back in April at Celebration 3, Lucasfilm was already working on not one but two Star Wars TV series, one live-action, one animated. In fact, the very building itself was intended to serve as a production facility for Star Wars TV shows, and if one line of discussion panned out, a whole TV channel dedicated to the franchise. These new initiatives, and the ultimate fight for survival that developed between them, would represent a kind of battle for the soul of Star Wars. Over the preceding years, especially after the delights of Young Indiana Jones and the agonies of the prequels, it had become apparent to Lucas that he was most comfortable as a TV kind of executive producer. A showrunner, basically. The kind that comes up with the overarching themes and directions of a fictional world, and then allows a bunch of smart writers to flesh it out. This was how Empire and Jedi had been written. The prequels had lacked any such writer's room conviviality, and fans had given Lucas hell for it. No wonder he yearned to get back to a collaborative mode of filmmaking. It had also been evident for years that animation was Lucas's first love, and that he found actors hard to manage. If there were a way to make movies without actors, Mark Hamill had suggested in the 1980s, George Lucas would do it. By the 2000s, computer animation was indeed offering Lucas a way to make movies without the inconvenience of actors, at least in their corporeal form. So, it is perhaps not surprising that the Star Wars live-action TV series would ultimately flounder, while the animated series, The Clone Wars, would go from strength to strength. The success of The Clone Wars was by no means a sure thing. The live-action series, developed under the working title of Star Wars Underworld, had a great deal of potential. Lucasfilm was in talks with ABC mostly, but also at one point HBO for the rights to screen it. Centered on the galactic capital of Coruscant in the two decades between Episode 3 and Episode 4, it would focus on the seedy underbelly of the Empire, the gangsters, smugglers, and bounty hunters who had been so missed by mature audiences in the prequels. It would also tie into a computer game of the same name, a game that was later renamed Star Wars 1313, and, even later, was shelved by Disney. Unconfirmed rumors suggest the series was to use Boba Fett as a recurring character. One ship we know was going to be featured in the show, according to design sketches, the Millennium Falcon. Underworld went through many years of intensive concept design. Lucas kept a small team of artists on the third floor of Skywalker Ranch, directly above his office, with private back stairs so he could reach them at any time. Polite to a fault, Lucas would always knock. Technically, they worked for another Lucasfilm subsidiary, JAK Enterprises, named for the first letters of Lucas's three kids. As one artist put it, George treated the third floor like his sketchpad. Rick McCallum, executive produced Underworld alongside Lucas. Both men described the show as dark, western-like Deadwood in space. But it soon appeared to the artists that they had distinctly different ideas about what this meant. McCallum saw a largely indoor drama that could be made very cheaply. But then George would come in and say, "Let's add another speeder bike chase," said a member of the production team. Lucas apparently wanted the show to focus on what the citizens of the galaxy did for fun. There would be more drag race-style pod races. The boy racer had never grown out of his need for speed. It could have been worse. Lucas would tweak McCallum by suggesting that Jar Jar Binks join the cast. McCallum let loose with a string of expletives, according to witnesses. Lucas was joking, but then again, Jar Jar did appear in the Clone Wars animated show. With George, McCallum knew, you really had to push back hard on Jar Jar. Lucas and McCallum conducted a global talent search. They reached out to writers such as Russell T. Davis, the Welsh showrunner who revived Doctor Who in 2005. Davis was thrilled to be asked, but too busy building his own little empire of science fiction TV shows. Rather than just set one writer to work on his own, the co-producers convened lavish multi-day international writers' conferences at Skywalker Ranch. The assembled talent would laugh and chat and eat and drink, and returned home to write around 100 scripts between them. One of the leading writers in the Skywalker Ranch conference was Ronald D. Moore, the man who rebooted Battlestar Galactica. The original Galactica, in 1978, had angered Lucas because, he said at the time, It spoiled the potential market for a Star Wars TV show. Then along came the series again in 2004, darker and far better and enrapturing all of geekdom for the next 5 years, just as Lucas was attempting to fulfill the promise of Star Wars on TV. But Moore's presence made it clear that Lucas held no grudge. In fact, he and McCallum sought to emulate it as much as possible. The sketchpad on the third floor of Skywalker Ranch was assigned to watch Battlestar Galactica episodes to figure out how the show could look so good on less than $3 million an episode. The trouble was, Lucas wasn't envisioning the sort of show that could be made on a shoestring. All those speeder bike chases and pod races added up. Underworld episodes were being priced out at roughly $11 million apiece, and original Star Wars every week. By 2009, Underworld was on the shelf, awaiting some form of future technology that could render galactic drag races more cheaply. "It would have been a great show," says Ronald D. Moore. "I'm disappointed I never got to see it happen." Then he casually revealed one of the characters involved. "I had the satisfaction of writing a few lines for Darth Vader." The chances of Underworld ever being made faded away. Lucas would start plundering the show's art for use in The Clone Wars, from season 2 onwards. Recycling ideas was a very Lucas-like trait, but some of the third-floor artists were upset. "We were building this show up, and it felt like bricks were being taken away," said one. But the artists had to be sanguine about it, he added. "George viewed our art as one big toy box. Anything he wanted to pull out in a particular situation was fine by him." The Clone Wars had begun as a series of short cartoons in 2002. This version of the series had been made by Genndy Tartakovsky, an award-winning Russian-born animator for Cartoon Network. Intended as promotional material to gin up interest in Episode 3, Tartakovsky's show had aired for 3 seasons, gaining 4 Emmys. Some viewers described it as the best Star Wars they'd ever seen. It offered stylized art and a relative lack of dialogue. Never a bad idea as far as Star Wars is concerned. Mace Windu silently destroying an entire robot army with a lightsaber and a lot of force. This alone was worth the cable subscription. Tartakovsky took General Grievous, a lightsaber-twirling cyborg he was required by Lucas to introduce because Grievous shows up in Episode 3, and made him far more scary in Stormtrooper White, a cyborg ghost. Lucas had big plans for the series. He wanted to fill in the gaps between Episode 2 and 3. What better way to burnish the reputation of the prequels than with more context, more answers, more adventure, more Star Wars? Lucas had been dreaming about the details of the Clone Wars for years, and then in Episode 3, most of the conflict happened off-screen. He never got his 7 battles on 7 planets. So once that movie was done, Lucas decided to reboot the Clone Wars cartoon into a CGI animated series. "We can do better," he said. Lucas saw the Clone Wars differently from Tartakovsky. He envisioned the show as more of a CGI version of Thunderbirds, a British-made puppet-filled science fiction show from the 1960s, than as the kind of stylized serial that Tartakovsky had turned it into. He also wanted 3D, which had turned a technological corner since the days of paper glasses. Lucas told Celebration 3 that Clone Wars would be made in this increasingly sophisticated format. Like Underworld, it was not to be. With 2 TV shows in development, and scripts pouring in for both, Lucas had precious little time for the sort of personal filmmaking he had mentioned at the Letterman Center and all those times before. Yet the creator still planned to go there, once the next thing was out of the way. "After the TV series, I'm going to do my own little movies," he told Time critic Richard Corliss in 2006. For the first time, he specified what those little movies were. A way to go back to his future. Back to plotless dystopian documentary fantasy. "Basically," he said, "you have to accept the fact that it's going to be the land of THX and worse." By now, Lucas could hardly ignore the fact that he'd been procrastinating on making those personal movies since 1977. I'm not saying I'm going to make these features fast, he added. That was just his style. I ruminate a lot and sit around. I'm one of these guys that come back and paint a little and then go back and paint a little bit more and come back a month later and paint a little bit more. I don't do things particularly quickly. I do when there's money involved, because I just can't afford to spend the money. There was money involved in the Clone Wars, which was the last remaining basket for Lucas to put his visual Star Wars eggs into. Having inked a deal with the Cartoon Network, he was committed to getting the show into syndication, which meant 100 episodes or more. He needed someone he could trust to steer the ship. Someone he could mentor. A fan, perhaps? Star Wars fans didn't come much more hardcore than Dave Filoni. For the premiere of Revenge of the Sith, Filoni had dressed up as Jedi Master Plo Koon, an obscure Star Wars character, if ever there was one. He was the guy with the weird perforated goggles and the breathing mask on the Jedi Council. Filoni had reason to celebrate by the time he put on that costume. A writer for the animated show Avatar, The Last Airbender, and a former animator on King of the Hill, he got a call from Lucasfilm about the possibility of working on another animated show. I talked a lot about Star Wars at work. A lot of people in animation talk about Star Wars at work, Filoni remembered 3 years later. I wasn't even aware that this job was out there, but friends of mine in the animation industry who know I'm into Star Wars put me up for it. He thought the call a practical joke by his friends on SpongeBob SquarePants. Luckily, he hung on long enough to hear that George really wanted to meet him. Later at Skywalker Ranch, Filoni nervously sat down with the creator and showed him a sketch of 5 characters. Asla, Sendak, Lunker, a Gungan who looked like a large Jar Jar, Cad, and Loop. Filoni's idea was that these characters were a team of Jedi and smugglers inserted into the galactic underworld during the Clone Wars to investigate the black market. All they would need was a cool ship, something like the Millennium Falcon. The Clone Wars would be like original trilogy Star Wars, in which the fun came from the nobles rubbing shoulders with the scruffy nerf herders. Major characters from the prequel trilogy could cross paths with these new characters every so often. It would be a treat for fans to see Anakin and Obi-Wan and others, but they wouldn't be the focus of the show. Lucas considered Filoni's idea and shook his head. No, he said, according to Filoni. I like my own characters. I want to get Anakin and Obi-Wan in. But there was one thing Filoni's sketch had given George an idea for. I want to give Anakin a Padawan, he said, pointing at the sketch of Asla. Let's take that girl there. George Lucas had 2 daughters, and he harbored a strong belief that science fiction and fantasy could, and should, appeal to pre-teenage girls. And thus, Asla was brought up in age and reborn as Ahsoka Tano, a.k.a. Snips, Padawan learner to Jedi Master Anakin Skywalker. The first outing for Ahsoka, Anakin, and Obi-Wan turned out not to be on the TV screen at all. After a few years of production work, with the scripts for the first season of The Clone Wars completed, Lucas viewed some of the early footage. Though he had his notes, Filoni says his team was told it was taking Star Wars too reverentially. Lucas made an apparently spontaneous decision that the first 4 episodes should be released as a movie. His executives were concerned, but not surprised. Sometimes George works in strange ways, shrugged licensing chief Howard Rothman, who set off to find as many last-minute licensing partners as he could so the movie would launch with at least some merchandising tie-ins. The Clone Wars movie was announced in February 2008 and debuted that August. It held a number of firsts in the Star Wars universe. It was the first animated Star Wars movie and the first to be released without the 20th Century Fox fanfare. The film was distributed by Warner Brothers, which was part of the same parent corporation as the Cartoon Network. Lucas, who had once wanted an internship at Warner's animation department, was finally doing one better by releasing an animated movie with the studio. At a running time of 98 minutes, Clone Wars was also the first Star Wars movie to last less than 2 hours. It was the first in which John Williams didn't have direct involvement, although a world music version of his theme is used in the film, as it is in the Clone Wars series itself. It was the first Star Wars movie that actually cost $8.5 million, the official budget for the original film. It had the fewest number of products attached, a few Hasbro figures, a McDonald's Happy Meal. Pepsi had a 10-year licensing deal with Lucasfilm. A Pepsi spokesperson said they weren't aware that Clone Wars was coming out. Clone Wars also holds the dubious distinction of most poorly reviewed Star Wars film ever. Lucas had ignored that old advice of Gene Roddenberry's. The TV shows invariably take a few episodes to warm up. Now here was Ahsoka's tentative early attempts at witty banter with her new master, Anakin, thrust into the spotlight of the movie theater. Action sequences dominated the film, looking like plotless experiments in CGI, which is in fact what they were. Entertainment Weekly critic Owen Gleiberman bemoaned the fact that the Star Wars universe was so obsessively, compulsively cluttered, yet trivial that it's no longer escapism. It's something you want to escape from. He branded Lucas the enemy of fun. This was the same year Pixar released its used universe masterpiece, WALL-E. Critics looking for a glimmer of hope in Clone Wars couldn't even fall back on the notion that its CGI animation was state-of-the-art. WALL-E seemed more Star Wars-like than this latest Star Wars. Even Roger Ebert, who had reliably supported Lucas throughout the prequel years, slammed, "A deadening film that cuts corners on its animation and slumbers through a plot that A, makes us feel like we've seen it all before, and B, makes us wish we hadn't." The movie bears a hideous 18% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, and made many annual worst-of-the-year lists. A few critics threw the ultimate slur. It was even worse than the holiday special. Looking back on it now, some cast members think Lucas probably didn't make the best decision of his life. "We weren't ready for prime time," says James Arnold Taylor, the voice of Obi-Wan throughout the series. "We were still working out the storytelling, the look and feel of the characters. I'm not knocking it. I just feel we could have had a better start." Did any of that matter for Lucasfilm's bottom line? Was The Clone Wars also the first dud movie in Star Wars history? Not in the slightest. The Clone Wars made $68.2 million at the box office, roughly 8 times its budget. In terms of return on investment, that made it more successful than Revenge of the Sith and Attack of the Clones, and on par with Phantom Menace. Once again, Lucas's strange ways had been vindicated at the box office. Star Wars moviegoing, it's an addiction, and millions of us are hooked. All that remained was for Lucas to prove that Clone Wars could make it as a TV show. He had set the bar at syndication, which meant Clone Wars would have to last for roughly 5 seasons, or from 2008 until 2013, which was how long Cartoon Network had the option to screen it for. But the network could also pull the plug at any time. The series started out strong. Its premiere was the highest rated in Cartoon Network history. Week to week, the first season averaged 3 million viewers. The reviews were uneven. Critics hated that the early episodes featured some of the prequel's weakest players, such as the battle droids, the ones that keep saying, "Roger, Roger," constantly miss fire, and are easily sliced by lightsabers, which dominated the first few episodes, and loathed even more the return of Jar Jar Binks. But the Clone Wars' greatest strength was that it had a long list of characters to follow. Episodes tended to bunch together in story arcs. You might have a Binks arc for a few weeks, then an Ahsoka or Anakin arc, then a Yoda arc after that. The same quality that made it uneven also gave it longevity. The universe was roomy. Miss the Han Solo-style smuggler Star Wars universe? Try the arcs featuring the feisty new pirate character, Hondo Ohnaka. Want more high fantasy with your Star Wars? Meet the mysterious magic-wielding Night Sisters. "We have stories for every type of fun," said Filoni. Clone Wars paid homage to Star Wars' hokey, earnest TV-screened origins. It was the closest thing the TV world had seen to Flash Gordon serials in a long time. The episodes, about 21 minutes each without commercials, lasted roughly the same time as a Flash Gordon. Each Clone Wars show opened with a different homily in the blue-on-black, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away font. Instead of a roll-up, Voice actor Tom Kane performed his best imitation of a 1940s newsreel announcer. Lucas had once said that the original trilogy was World War II, and the prequels were more like the Great War. But the newsreel introduction made us feel like this was World War II. A good and worthy war with the voice of the Republic, pulling us all together in the great struggle against evil Dooku and his separatists. The fact that the whole war was actually a Sith plot added a layer of irony that was, unfortunately, rarely examined in the show. There were times when Lucas seemed to be mentoring Filoni, grooming him as a sort of successor, schooling him in World War II and Kurosawa. For one episode, landing at Point Rain, Lucas threw the script out and made Filoni cut together actual film footage from movies such as The Longest Day, Tora Tora Tora, and Battle of the Bulge. Lucas pulled out his reels from back when he was cutting together dogfights for the original Star Wars. Filoni absorbed Lucas' influences and shared them with the crew. He made sure that every one of his animators watched Seven Samurai, the plot of the second season episode Bounty Hunters, in which Anakin and Obi-Wan protect a planet of farmers, paid direct homage to the Kurosawa film. Lucas would barely talk to the Clone Wars artists, but was having a whale of a time during meetings in the writer's room with Filoni and six other writers. Once a week, Lucas would come in with a few ideas. He tended to be the creative impetus behind the episodes of the show that focus entirely on the clones. The series took a bunch of soldiers who were supposed to look and talk the same way, all modeled on the Maori actor Temuera Morrison, who played Jango Fett, and developed different personalities for them, such as Rex, Cody, Fives, and an older, wiser clone named Gramps. After being presented with such an idea, the writers at the meeting were then free to debate whether it would actually work, but Lucas would want to hear the result. "He always wanted to be there to push us," said Filoni. The show initially aired on Friday nights at 9 p.m., which wanted a large adult audience. But as Filoni catered more and more to that audience with darker scripts and better animation, viewership declined from 3 million for Series 1 to about 1.6 million for Series 4. For Series 5, Cartoon Network tried something that was either radical or suicidal. It moved Clone Wars to Saturday mornings at 9:30 a.m. Ratings barely moved. Still, the fifth season was number one in its time slot among boys aged between 9 and 14, which was and remains Star Wars' core demographic, despite attempts to bring in the girls with characters like Ahsoka and her fellow Padawan, Barriss Offee. The scripts got darker still. Darth Maul returned from his bisection in Phantom Menace, his lower half a skittering mechanical spider. The show was approaching what some fans call a MASH problem. It had been running for longer than the 3 years the Clone Wars themselves were supposed to last, just as MASH was on TV for longer than the Korean War. But Clone Wars had the inherent advantage of being set in the Star Wars universe. Remember, the original movie covers the course of 3 or 4 days at most. 3 years might be enough to keep the show in business for a lifetime. Season 5 ended on March 2, 2013. With the show's most shocking cliffhanger. Ahsoka, wrongly accused but exonerated of bombing the Jedi Temple, walks away from the Jedi Order. Filoni talked confidently about tying up some more loose ends in the sixth season. One of the clones would discover the terrifying truth about the forthcoming Order 66 that was to wipe out the Jedi. Yoda would go on a galactic voyage that would allow him to commune with the dead and learn the secret of how to become a Force ghost. The show had vaulted over the 100-episode hurdle, but we need 100 more just to finish what we're trying to do, Filoni told Star Wars Insider. By that point, however, Filoni had a new boss who didn't like what she saw in the Clone Wars bottom line. On March 11, the plug was unceremoniously pulled. 27. Hello, Disney. In January 2012, George Lucas chose a maroon sofa in his animation studios at Skywalker Ranch, beneath two paintings of Padme, as the place where he would tell the world he was retiring from Star Wars. "I'm moving away from the business, from the company, from all this kind of stuff," he explained to New York Times freelance reporter Brian Curtis. Once again, he declared his intention to get back to making personal films. Reporters who'd been around the block a few times raised their eyebrows. The ostensible sub